Alrighty, welcome to the podcast. I'm John Tesh with Give Gerard, and coming up today, we know that salmon is one of the healthiest things we can eat, but now researchers say we should be eating like salmon, as if we were salmon.
Okay.
Now, also, we'll tell you why, ever since COVID, people are going crazy buying millions of bidets for their bathrooms. We'll tell you what's going on there.
You'll need one. You don't need a million of them. You just need the one.
We'll also tell you why research shows that too much free time can lead to a decline in mental health. How about that? So people are unretiring. We'll talk about it.
Okay. I mean, I think it's all the same thing. Too much free time and unretiring. That's it's all tied in together.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
We'll tell you why parents are now starting to name their kids not after politicians or even famous people, but after firearms.
I don't like any of the. I don't know why those are the only three options. Let's go with. Is there an option D?
And I'm so excited about all these topics because I feel like I've been chained to my piano here in the studio for months and months working on this piano course.
You've been killing yourself.
It's actually so new for me, you know. I mean, I've been playing since I was 6 years old, but I've never taught piano, especially teaching online where you can't, like, put your hands and, I mean, move somebody's hands and, you know, and stuff like that.
Right.
But it's been fascinating because, you know, we just released it, as you know,
yep,
to a smaller group of people, and then they said, whoa, 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 you're going too fast, and including my wife, your mom,
yeah,
said, like, well, no. So she's already learned how to play 1.5 songs, but it's basically no sheet music, no music theory. It's just because people, especially people my age, like, I always wanted to do this, kind of just learn how to play a song.
Right, right. And so this will give you the ability to play. You'll learn to play some songs starting with your songs.
Right.
And then, by the way, that's the way to keep the stoke of learning an instrument is you learn a song,
yeah,
and then you learn a little bit more. And as you do, you learn the chords and the fingering, and then you keep adding songs to your repertoire. And doing so, you learn more music theory. But having the first song that you can play and kind of get addicted to and get addicted to that feeling of practicing, that's key.
And I've seen it with my wife. I mean, when you start playing with two hands, your brain is just lit up. We know that it's great for your brain.
How many stories have we done about learning an instrument, what it does for your brain, and two hands. The more parts of your brain you're using in tandem for any task, whether that's writing notes in a class to understand the material better.
Yeah.
So by handwriting your notes, you're going to understand the material better. Whether it's saying things out loud in order to memorize, or playing an instrument where you have to use more parts of your brain.
Yeah.
All that does is it prevents Alzheimer's. It makes you smarter in other ways. It's just so good for you.
Yeah, that's well said. If you want more information, just go to Tesh.com. We have 200 more spots that are open right now to learn how to play piano. Let's talk about how important it is to eat like salmon. Now, I know it sounds weird.
Sitting in a river with our mouth open?
Yeah. Knowing that salmon is one of the healthiest things we can eat, we know that. But now the researchers who have studied this, Gib, they say we should be eating like salmon, like we were salmon.
Yeah.
So listen to the study and we'll get your opinion on this. It's a study in the journal Nature Food. It found that consuming the sort of wild fish that salmon prey on, so mackerel, herring, and anchovies, could be healthier than eating salmon itself. And by directly eating more wild feed species, we can improve our health while also reducing demand for salmon that leads to overfishing. So we're basically cutting out the middleman, right?
I mean, you're getting the stuff that the food eats.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
You're eating what the food eats.
Yeah,
and so you're processing. There's nothing in mackerel or sardines or anchovies that you can't digest.
Can I ask you a question? I thought mackerel was like as big as salmon. Is it small?
It's smaller.
Okay,
yeah,
all
yeah.
right.
Mackerel,
I guess it would
sharks
have to be.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, salmon are pretty aggressive. But look, you and I, we like salmon.
Yeah, we do.
We eat a lot of salmon. You know, if you're at the right restaurant, that's number one for you and me to pick.
Yeah.
But I can't get behind these smaller fish. I can't do
it. We've tried with the anchovy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are people who just, I mean, there's that guy, Dominic D'Agostino, who's the big keto guy.
Yeah, he travels with anchovies and sardines.
In those tins,
yeah,
right?
And also clams, canned clams.
Yeah, I bought both of those at Erewhon. I think that it may be the hair for me. Fish with hair is weird.
It weirds me out. It's such a strong taste, especially the canned stuff, which I know is, you know, we talk a lot about how when it, if it's done properly, getting it right from the can where it's processed right away and preserved away is actually in some ways fresher than waiting for it, you know, the quote unquote fresh fish that's been frozen for a little while.
I know you've reported on this before. Why is it again that the small fish are so much healthier for us?
Well, they've got all the nutrients that we want in the bigger fish, but they have, you know, mercury and other heavy metals that work their way up the food chain. Also other diseases that work their way up the food chain. They're not as in high concentration in the little fish, because the salmon is eating all the fish that have the mercury in them. And then what ends up happening is it becomes concentrated in that. So the higher up the food chain you go, the more likely you are to get some of those negative, because again, they're eating all the stuff that's eating all the stuff, and it becomes more concentrated. So like if you're eating shark, you're getting a lot of mercury.
Yeah.
If you're eating, when you're eating salmon, you're getting a lot of that. Tuna, same thing.
Yeah. So if you eat like a salmon, you're going to get, so that's, we mentioned that's mackerel, herring, and anchovies. You get a pile of iodine and calcium and iron, vitamin B12, vitamin A, as Gib mentioned, omega-3, and then vitamin D and zinc and selenium.
So we know that it's better, right? And this is the thing that happens on the show a lot of times, is that we'll tell you that this is the best way. But I want you all to know, just put this in your back pocket. If you can stomach this stuff, go ahead and eat it and know that you're better than everybody else. But we're going to keep eating salmon. Like, this is better, but we're going to keep eating the salmon because I like how it tastes better.
Maybe I could put it in a blender. You know, you remember
the bit? That sounds disgusting.
The bit on Saturday Night Live when Dan Aykroyd put bass in the Bass-O-Matic?
Yeah. No, oh, gosh. Here's the thing. I say how disgusting that is, but then, like, a good anchovy paste, making real anchovies in a Caesar salad, I love.
All right. So that's the bottom line. As we experts, researchers want us to eat like a salmon. Let's talk about salmon's good for your brain. Let's talk about what else is good for your brain. It turns out that the more things that we try to remember at once, the more likely we are to forget everything. Lots of studies on this. And it turns out it's because our brain does have a limited capacity in short-term working memory. This comes from scientists at the University of Texas who just finished the study on this. They found that when people overloaded their brains by trying to remember too many things at once, their brain essentially started kicking out memories to make room for new information. They say it's kind of like musical chairs. There are only so many spots, so something is going to get left out. And the more we try to cram it in, the more we'll forget things. So they say it's best to write down the important stuff. This is good. That will code the information in the brain in two ways, through sight, through sound, and depending on whether you're reading information or hearing it, and touch from physically writing it down.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's that. First of all, that's all well and good in how it codes your brain. But also, now it's written down. You don't have to remember it. And even that, by the way, just writing it down sometimes will make it easier to remember because you're not stressing about remembering it anymore. Not only have you engaged more of your brain in the process of understanding it, but you now you don't have the stress, the cortisol that blocks memory formation of I can't forget this. Once you write it down, you've taken the pressure off, and you're much more likely to perform better in terms of memory tests when you don't have that kind of stress. So yeah, that makes sense. The other thing is, we do too much multitasking. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
we're constantly doing 5-6 things. If I'm at the gym, I'm also checking my email. If I'm at the kids' soccer game, I get text messages and I'm checking them. And our brains are not meant for that. If I'm writing for the show, emails and texts are coming in and it takes me away from it. We have lost the ability to stay focused for a long period of time, and our brains really can't handle what we're doing.
Yeah. Again, from University of Texas, bottom lining this, the more things we try to remember at once, the more likely we are to forget everything. We have to offload as much as we can. So I recently told you the one silver lining of the pandemic was an increase in marriages and a decrease in divorces. You know, a lot of new data is coming in now from, you know, 2020 and what happened during the pandemic years. And there's something else that is happening now. Well, during the pandemic, people discovered bidets.
Oh, yeah.
And you may wonder, bidet, why? Well, you, of course, remember this when we were all fighting each other for rolls of toilet paper and people were hoarding and it was a big news story. It did prompt people, a lot of people, to buy bidets and install them in their bathroom. James Lynn is the founder of a very popular website, Gabe. It's called bidetking.com.
I can't believe he was able to get that. It's unbelievable.
You think it was
I'm surprised it wasn't already taken.
Yeah, exactly. I am the king. It's an online marketplace for bidets. course. He says pretty much nobody regrets buying a bidet. That's a great marketing slogan. Yeah. Nobody regrets buying a bidet. It saves on toilet paper, and toilet paper can make conditions like urinary tract infections and hemorrhoids worse. One more thing, Gib, before I turn you loose here. The bidet attachment company, Tushy,
yep,
says the... which is my nickname in high school, of course, says the revenue continues to increase 20% year over year, and people are giving bidets as gifts.
So we're getting ready to remodel. One of my conditions is I want one of those new super toilets in the master.
Oh, I've seen those in, or I've experienced those in hotel rooms.
They have, it has the bidet built into it. It's also a toilet. I because they are great, and they get you cleaner. I mean, not to be too graphic about it, but you're definitely, in fact, people in like in France, in cultures where bidets are very popular, can't believe that we just use dry paper. So, it absolutely gets you. I'm a big fan. You don't have one in your bathroom, but you could get the Tushy attachment to your toilet.
Connie has one in her bathroom.
I know she does. Yeah. But you guys, so I look.
The Tushy attachment.
If you're not doing
is that going to show up on my credit card?
Yes. And the worst thing about it is you really only need one bidet. And then the next thing you know, all you're getting all the time are email marketing. You bought the bidet. Have you thought about buying another bidet?
You might also like.
Right.
Yeah. That's amazing. The toilet paper shortage.
They're great. Go ahead and get. I'm going to get. That's. I know what I'm getting you for your birthday is the Tushy attachment.
Thank you so much. Question here for the moment, Gib, is have your kids ever asked you about life before the internet?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So they can't comprehend it.
So apparently this is a huge topic of interest for Gen Z. People born after 1996 and Generation Alpha. I didn't even know that's what they were called. Generation Alpha.
That's my oldest daughter's Generation Alpha.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Kids born after 2010.
Yeah,
because neither of the generation they don't know what it's like, you know.
Yeah.
So boomers, Gen Xers, and older millennials are now the last people to remember what it was like to use a payphone, a typewriter, or an encyclopedia. You're right on the cusp of two of those.
Yeah,
and it's fascinating to young people. They can't imagine how we socialized, how we met romantic partners, how did we get where we're going, how did we find a job or research information.
It was hard
before the 1990s. Yeah, it was work, right?
Yeah,
do the work, kids. So now what they're doing. And we see the popularity in the data that comes from Netflix and Paramount Plus and all that. People are watching vintage TV shows like Friends and Seinfeld to actually try and catch a glimpse of what life was like, and watching movies that took place in pre-internet times, which now feel like, quote, period films.
So, yes, absolutely. So my kids, like I said, they can't comprehend what life was like. I'm what's called an elder millennial. I'm like born, like you said, right. I don't have a lot of the things that most millennials associate with, because as a kid, we did not have the internet. I'm in that older age where when I was in high school, people didn't have cell phones.
Right.
I didn't get a cell phone until late in college. And, that created a very different cultural experience than people who were born just a few years after me, because it really is. Obviously, there's been nothing that has shifted the culture the way that this has. And the amount of information that you have at your fingertips at any given time, like we used to have to, there's an encyclopedia downstairs because I had to look stuff up in the encyclopedia. So my kids asked me about it, and they thought that the internet came out of like the plugs in the wall. So they thought that because I didn't have internet, I didn't have electricity. I had to explain to them the difference there. So there's old movies that you watch, like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids has all these weird gadgets in it. But my kids don't know what the weird gadgets are and what the normal things for kids and adults, like a wall phone. They've never lived in a house with a wall phone. So you have to explain, no, the wall phone is not one of his weird inventions. It's just the wall phone. The weird, the breakfast making machine, that's the weird invention.
Yeah, I remember coming home from school and I could tell where one of my sisters was by the curly Q cord that was attached to the wall that went into the closet.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The little bit of privacy you could get was taking the corded phone and stretching it as far as you could go to get away from everybody else.
So social scientists are using terms like, quote, digital immigrants and the, quote, the last of the innocents to describe people who came of age in the era of record players, answering machines, and paper maps. I remember when I first was on Entertainment Tonight in 1986, and I didn't have a cell phone.
Right.
And Mary Hart, my co-host at the time, had one. She was walking around with it. She looked like an army infantryman, radio man.
Right.
Because she had like a suitcase that she was carrying with one hand, and the phone was attached to the side of it, and she had a whip antenna that was extended, like, I don't know, 12 feet above her head.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I thought she was calling in an airstrike.
Yeah. You know? No, she was just super important and on the cutting edge of technology. I mean, look, it used to be ridiculous, and now you can't imagine living without it.
Yeah.
It's wild. But I miss it. I'm trying to give my kids as many of those experiences as possible.
Yeah.
So like, they don't have cell phones, even though, you know, my daughter's 12. She's in sixth grade. And we just signed a pledge that we're not going to give our kids phones until they're in eighth grade.
I love it.
Because there's something to be said about having to learn things, about having to experience things in the flesh before you give the digital, you know, the digital connection to them.
Yeah. And you know, Gib and I, you know what we've sort of dedicated our lives to, a mission and purpose, which is to move you forward in your life, you know, personal development. Now we know more about, it's being studied, free time is being studied. The latest research shows too much of it, too much free time, will likely lead to a decline in mental health. So this is a new study in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. They found there's a sweet spot for the perfect amount of free time. They say it's about 3.5 hours a day.
That's a lot of free time.
That. I was like, oh, thank you.
I'll take it.
So they say if you have more free time than that, your sense of well-being starts to take a hit. Wow. So some people, I guess, maybe 8 hours of free time. I don't know.
I got a friend who, I call him at like 10:30 in the morning, and he's like, oh, I'm just getting out of bed. And I'm like, okay. Yeah, yeah. All right, buddy.
Turns out having too much free time is associated with having a lack of purpose. There it is. It really matters how you spend your free time. So you're going to get credit if you spend your free time gardening, exercising, socializing, or reading. You will, just from that, dramatically improve your sense of well-being, purpose.
It was sometimes too, you know, if you have a lot going on, it's almost easier to be more productive. And we talk about this, like if you are on a sports team, right, in school, when the sports is over, you have to immediately start your homework because otherwise you're going to be up until 3 o'clock in the morning. That you have to be ahead of it and it keeps you more focused and intentional. But if you know you have all day to do something, then you're never, if you have one thing to do in a day, you're going to wait until the last possible second. If you have 10 things to do in a day, you'll probably get 9 things done. If you only have one, the chances of you getting that thing done are about 50-50. So I think it's that feeling of, oh, I have nothing I'm really needing to do. I'm not, and then you become overall less productive, and it's a downward cycle of depression.
That's good. That's good. Again, research shows too much free time can actually be toxic.
Yeah, I want to be in that situation. I want to have so much free time that I can be toxic because I have not had that kind of time in a very long time.
All right, coming up, we're going to tell you why 10 minutes of playing cornhole will help you focus and get more done. Why more people are using apps and tracking their glucose levels for longevity. Would you do this?
It seems a little invasive, but I mean, I've done way weirder stuff than just tracking my glucose.
Yeah, I think I'm in on this. Plus, we'll tell you why parents, speaking of weird, parents are now naming their kids after firearms. That's all just ahead, but first, this. You know, what I hear from many people who come up to me after my live concerts is, oh, John, I've always wanted to play the piano, but I don't have time for all those lessons. Or they say, I'm too old to start learning now. I can teach you how to play a song on the piano in just 3 days without spending 1 minute learning music theory or reading sheet music. We do this together by me teaching you how to play my most memorable songs. So go to Tesh.com right now and get on the waiting list for my brand new online course, The John Tesh Piano Method. It's Tesh.com, Tesh.com. When you have a moment, please visit Tesh.com. This is where you can get access to my music and live concerts and also find out about my new online piano course, The John Tesh Piano Method. Plus, you can join me for my weekly VIP coaching. The John Tesh VIP coaching program is an opportunity for you to get personal coaching from me in a small group environment. You get strategies plus encouragement and accountability. Plus, live weekly Zoom calls, everything you need to create the next chapter in your life. It's all waiting for you at Tesh.com. Welcome back to the podcast. Thanks for sticking around, or if you fast-forwarded, welcome. I'm just sort of thinking about what I do with podcasts sometimes.
I don't like that.
Here, I like this. Okay. Excuse me. We already track our sleep, our steps, and our heart rate.
Yep. Guilty.
Me too. And next is glucose. And I'm going to tell you something. Well, I'll go through this, but I'm in on this because we've all, both of you, both you and I have seen so much research on this.
Yes.
Blood sugar levels. Yeah. So it is now one of the fastest growing trends in health and wellness, not just for diabetics anymore. It turns out 1 in 3 North American adults, 1 out of 3, Gib, are now living with diabetes or pre-diabetic.
Unbelievable.
That is huge.
Unbelievable.
That's an epidemic.
Yeah.
Now, even if you're not, more people want to monitor their blood sugar. And the FDA, they just approved the first over-the-counter device. This thing uses sensors attached to microneedles to continuously measure glucose levels, and it's being marketed to non-diabetics. The thinking here is that when people can see how food and exercise affect their glucose levels, then they'll adjust their lifestyle. And by keeping glucose levels stable, people can burn stored fat for energy and lose weight. This is like those restaurants who put the calorie count up there for all the fast food that we never pay any attention to.
I've made decisions based on it. If I'm not too hungry, if I'm really hungry, it's like 1,400 calories sounds perfect. But if I'm not too hungry, that's 950 calories, I'm making a different decision.
The only thing that gets my attention is the frosty snow metal or whatever that thing is from Burger King. It's super slushy.
Isn't that like 1,800 calories?
Yeah, that's where I draw the line.
Okay, good for you. We all have that line. But to your point, right? We have all kinds of data in our lives, and early information is so key. Early signals of the diseases that we have coming down the pipe are the key to preventing the damage from it. So if you can get precancerous cells nipped in the bud, you never have to have the detrimental effects of the actual cancer. If you can understand your glucose levels to the point where you don't need insulin and you don't become fully diabetic, then it's way easier. And when we were doing full keto, when you were in the middle of chemo and we were doing full keto, and we would prick our fingers 2-3 times a day check our ketone levels. And in that process, I mean, that was intense. My fingers started hurting. Even just now thinking about it, it was such an intense time checking your blood constantly. But the new glucose monitors, have you seen what they look like? They look like a little patch on the back of your arm. And it
has a readout on the patch?
It's done on a patch. It's got like a Bluetooth thing to your phone.
Oh my gosh.
So basically you're constantly monitoring your glucose. This comes from the onset of the glucose pumps that are popular with people with diabetes now. And you need that constant feedback of where your glucose is. Basically, you're offboarding your pancreas. But if you could just put that on your arm and you have constant blood glucose readings, that makes it hard to say no to this. You know what I mean?
Offboarding my pancreas?
Yeah, with the little insulin pumps that they have.
I got you.
Feedback from the glucose monitor, and then it just tells the insulin pump to give you more insulin.
Yeah, it just triggered a memory of me, feeling that back in the 70s in New York, that my liver was trying to offboard itself.
Yeah, I mean, what's his name? Keith Richards has been offboarding his liver for a while.
Oh my gosh,
those blood switchers.
I mean, I'm looking this up now.
If you get one, I'll take one.
Okay, Christmas. Here we go. Okay, so have you? I'm sure you have ever been to a restaurant with a handwritten menu, one that uses a font that just looks like handwriting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember back in the 70s in New York, they used to have chalkboards. They still do, right?
Yeah.
They have a chalkboard with the menu written on it. Well, we now know that it makes us think the food is healthier. This was researched, right? I had no idea. This is researched by Ohio State University. The folks there found that when menus appear to be handwritten as opposed to printed in a standard font, diners believe the food will be better for them, even if the actual menu items are identical. They also felt the food was more likely to be locally grown, organic, and hormone-free. The researchers say seeing handwriting makes customers feel like the food has more heart, more effort, and love in it. The power of the chalkboard. Amazing.
So, there's so much that we, and I love unpacking this on the show, is about the mentality that we have with food, our mental attachment to food, our emotional attachment to food. They did that thing where
It's a whole school at Cornell University, the Food and Brands Laboratory. Right.
So you put fast food cheeseburgers on a plate and you space it out properly and it looks like a cheeseburger that you get at a fancy restaurant and you think it tastes better, right? We've talked about that before. And this is the same kind of thing. You take the same menu and you make it look like it's catch of the day all of a sudden you're going to feel a much, oh, this was pulled out of the ocean today. Doesn't matter that it's frozen tilapia. You just, because it's handwritten, it feels like they didn't have a choice. We didn't have time to get the menus printed. We had to hand write them because the food is that fresh. Yeah. We just found out that Swiss chard was available at cost today. So that's what's on the menu. Oh my gosh, Swiss chard. Sign me up.
I've told this story to you before and to the family, but I don't think these folks have heard this story. My experience where they...
I know what this is. By the way, we were going to say this on the radio show. We didn't have time. This is exactly why you need to listen to the podcast, is for stories like this.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Or to unsubscribe, depending on how the story's going to go.
If you don't like this, then unsubscribe right now.
So 1976, I'm hired to be a news correspondent at WCBS Channel 2 in New York. They're, you know, the flagship news station for CBS Network. And I'm in there, and I'm working. And the newsroom was amazing. In the newsroom, I'm a cub reporter at 23 years old. I'd just come from Nashville, where I was working with Pat Sajak and those guys. And so here I am, you know, I knew New York. I grew up on Long Island, but I'm a fish out of water. And I've got, you know, John Stossel to my left, Meredith Vieira to my right. You know, Bill O'Reilly had just left the newsroom. Linda Ellerbee, you know, all these people in the newsroom there.
Big names.
Yeah, they became big names for sure. And so I'm there for about 2 weeks, and Stossel, John Stossel, who you may remember from 2020 and from Fox News, Stossel took me under his wing, and he was a little older than me. And so he said, hey, let's go out to lunch. And again, I'd been there for like 2 weeks, right? And I've been on the air, you know, anchoring the weekend show and also doing some stuff and reporting. And so I'm sitting there, I'm talking to him at this little restaurant, lunch restaurant on the east side of New York. We're facing each other. And I'm sitting there, and he's talking to me, and I said, John, just stop for a second. I'm going crazy here. I've got this big smile on my face. He goes, what's going on? I said, I mean, all these people are like, I've been on the news for 2 weeks, and everybody in this place recognizes me. They're all pointing at me and leaning in and talking to each other. And Stossel is just so great. You know, Stossel goes, you're an idiot. And I said, what? He goes, the menu's behind you. And so I look behind me, and the chalkboard menu is there. Right?
So one of the many dangers of the handwritten menu is that you will think that you're a little bit more famous than you are.
And that was the moment I became humble for the rest of my life. You know, be careful. There may always be a menu behind you.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, the chalkboard menu, handwritten, and you all of a sudden thought, man, I'm the toast of the town.
Yeah. Reason enough to listen to the podcast, as Gib said. There it is. Apparently, parents, Gib, we love following these trends, but parents, they decided, gosh, I guess about every 2 or 3 months we have a baby naming trend story, right? Things like that, you know, because
it keeps changing.
Right. I'll ask you this question later, but the trend is that parents don't want to name their kids after politicians anymore.
Obviously not
modern politicians. I mean, you say obviously, but in the 1920s, names of past presidents like Cleveland and Roosevelt, they were top names, like the top five names given to babies. And when presidents Harding and Wilson served their terms, both names spiked in popularity following their elections. Today, almost no babies, according to Nameberry, no babies are being given the names Biden, Trump, or Obama.
Yeah.
However, more parents are now naming their kids after firearms. Okay. And you're like, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
So the top gun-related names showing up on birth certificates in recent years, so they're not guessing, they're seeing this on birth certificates.
Right.
They include Shooter, Trigger, Beretta, Ruger, and Caliber. Trigger is the name of a horse, by the way, folks.
Trigger is the name of a horse. Shooter is the name of a villain in an old Adam Sandler movie called Happy Gilmore.
Is it Ruger, one of the Willis kids? That's Rumor. Sorry.
I feel like there's so many other sources you could get your names from. You don't have to choose politicians or guns. You could pick something completely different. You can pick like places. You name it after name it after where you met your wife.
Alps.
Yeah, fine. Alps. Barcelona.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, France. This is my daughter, France.
I think there are some.
I'm sure. I feel like there's not a lot of good news that comes out about firearms, and you don't want your kid's name trending.
Yeah, that's
somebody,
the thing. Yeah,
when the Beretta has an issue, right? You don't want to be attached to that. Pick a new source. There's great names. There's old prophets in the Bible you could name your kids after. There's all the hobbits in Lord of the Rings. Some great names there. Pick something else.
Hey, it's time for lunch, AK-47. This doesn't work.
Alexei Kalashnikov. That's the AK.
I understand. Yeah. We gave a tip not long ago on the radio show about a great way to test a baby name is to go to a Starbucks. And when they ask you for your name on the coffee cup, you give. Remember this? You remember this?
They give
the name that you're thinking about for your baby, and then when they finish your drink, they'll say, you know,
is so dark.
Beretta.
But imagine if the guy's yelling shooter, and everybody's hitting the deck. I know it's dark, but think about that.
I know. Yeah.
Shooter, get down. I go yeah.
Or just gun.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
All right. So that's the latest on that.
Pick a family member. Pick a great aunt. Name your kid after the great aunt.
Like I said, this will be a conversation starter for you because it has become one for us. We now have an odd product. We're all about productivity. We're all about, personal development, all that stuff, you know, health, wellness, longevity. And focus is hard because of all the distractions that we have now. And in fact, one of the most popular books out there, given I've recommended it before, is Cal Newport's Deep Work.
Great book.
It's about how to just take a moment during the day. It could be a half hour. It could be 6 hours, like writer, author Ryan Holiday, and do deep work. But now there's a hack that'll help you buckle down and focus. You just stop what you're doing and you take 10 minutes to play ping pong or cornhole. So according to UCLA scientists, moving your arms, quote unquote, for 10 minutes triggers the release of endorphins, and those endorphins increase your ability to focus by 80% for 2 hours. And I was thinking they would say, you know, I didn't see cornhole coming. I it's like ping pong, tennis, badminton, something like that. But no, they're recommending that's the bean bag
toss. You throw it on like a little wood slat with a hole in it.
Yeah, I don't think we ever saw this in New York. Maybe
no, there's not enough room to play cornhole in New York. You need at least 15 feet of unencumbered space.
I mean, folks, you're with me. We played stickball and Ringolivio.
Yeah,
but no cornhole. So
yeah, well, it's much
more. How big is the playing field for this thing?
You know, you put them like 15, 20 feet apart, and you toss them. If you, by the way, not to go off on a tangent here,
they used to throw. I think we're on one.
Yeah.
Did they used to throw corn cobs?
I'm sure they were like corn cob sacks because you throw the bean bags, but I'm sure they at one point were full of something else. But if you on ESPN now, they have the World Championship Cornhole.
And
the people that play are so good. It's insane. I'm a big fan of backyard games and tailgating, so I've played my fair share of cornhole, my fair share of ping pong in my day. The people that are really good at this are insane. I mean, like, they can not just get it in the hole, but get it in the hole without knocking anybody else's beanbag that's hanging over the hole. They are so good at it. It's unbelievable.
Is there money exchanging hands here? Gambling?
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's gambling. Yeah, sure there's billions in sponsorship dollars.
Do these people look like they're in shape or are they?
They do not. It looks very similar to like bowling. There's some people who are fit and some people who are 3 inches away from an aneurysm. So that it's both. But the point is that they're all super focused because that process helps you focus. We see this in like Silicon Valley companies too, because they put the beanbag
foosball,
ping pong, cornhole. It's all in the lobby there, and those guys they got to go up and code for 17 more hours. So there's got to be something to it.
Okay. Well, hopefully it'll never hit the Olympics, but
I bet you. Watch this. 2030, it'll be there.
Okay. That's all we got today. We thought we would end with the cornhole thing. Let us know how you feel about any of this stuff. You can always email us. It's john@tesh.com. And of course, you know we would love to have you as a regular subscriber so you can get notified every time we launch an episode. If you wanted to learn how to play a song on the piano or keyboard, I can make that happen for you. The new online course is called the John Tesh Piano Method. Learn how to play piano, learning my songs. So you can learn songs from all 7 of my PBS specials. But hey, who wouldn't want to learn how to play the NBA basketball song right now? Come on.
I
can teach you how to do that.
You could play it along while your friends are playing cornhole. He sinks the topper.
Topper?
Yeah, if you get a beanbag in on top of somebody else's, it's a topper, you can take their points.
You know way too much about
backyard games.
I knew you knew baseball, but top, the cornhole?
Oh, yeah.
All right. You can find my piano course at Tesh.com and no reference at all to cornhole. Thanks for joining
us. Not yet.
Yeah. You know, what I hear from many people who come up to me after my live concerts is, oh, John, I've always wanted to play the piano, but I don't have time for all those lessons. Or they say, I'm too old to start learning now. I can teach you how to play a song on the piano in just 3 days without spending 1 minute learning music theory or reading sheet music. We do this together by me teaching you how to play my most memorable songs. So go to Tesh.com right now and get on the waiting list for my brand new online course, The John Tesh Piano Method. It's Tesh.com. Tesh.com.